Welcome back to the Munich Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
Here at the Munich Movie Club, we're a group of friends who pick a group of three movies every month to discuss on our website, munichmovie.club. At the end of the month, after we've written reviews for those three movies, we get together on this podcast and discuss what we thought, how they work, how they didn't work, whether they should exist at all or not. And this last month, we discussed News of the World and Coda and Many Saints of Newark. Pierce only saw Many Saints of Newark, so we get to hear his dulcet tones on this first movie before he'll take off. And then I'm going to monologue my way through the last two movies. So get ready for a lot of thoughts about journalism in News of the World, just to keep the listeners on the hook. Many Saints of Newark is a Sopranos prequel. Written by the series creator of The Sopranos, David Chase, and directed by Alan Taylor, who broke out as a TV director and made several failing blockbusters like Terminator Genesis and Thor the Dark World. Well, Thor the Dark World didn't fail, just pretty universally regarded as the worst MCU movie, here nor there. This movie takes place in the 60s during the Newark riots and a little bit thereafter. And Tony Soprano is a teenager in the thrall of Dickie Moltisanti, his uncle and pseudo-mentor. Pierce, initial thoughts, Many Saints in Newark.
I think there's two realms with which you have to judge the movie. One being a Sopranos prequel and two being a mafia movie. I think it was kind of average at both. The Sopranos prequel part of it, I liked better. I was actually shocked that was the part I liked. I thought they did a really good job portraying some of those characters' younger versions. But the, like, mafia movie at the center of the whole thing, I thought was incredibly generic and very unnecessary. So I didn't think it was a failure, maybe, as a movie on its own. But I think in the context of, like, did I need a Sopranos prequel movie? I don't know if it necessarily sold me on returning to, you know, the Sopranos version of New Jersey, right? Like, so I'm kind of on the fence with it.
Yeah, I think that in the series of The Sopranos, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about, we've been podcasting about it for the last month or so. Like, within the show, there's all this talk about this period of time in the mob and Tony, you know, he starts the series talking about how he missed out on the good times. Mm-hmm. Feels like he came in on the end of something. So, like, this period of history, like, if Chase was going to return to The Sopranos, it was always going to be here. He's talked about it for a long time. He's talked about making this a series as opposed to a movie. But David Chase has, like, a serious inferiority complex about TV and movies. Like, he's always wanted to make movies, and even with The Sopranos, you kind of get the sense that he's always felt stuck in TV and doesn't think that much of it. You can imagine, like, the miniseries version of this, I think, more than the movie version. I pretty much agree with you, Pierce, that, like, of the two halves of this movie, both of which I like well enough, and I agree I like The Sopranos prequel more, but The Sopranos prequel part is the unnecessary part. And the fleshing out of, like, who this fabled figure, Dickie Moltisanti, who figures pretty heavily in the show and is never shown in any of the handful of flashbacks that the series does. Like, he was worthy of his own movie in the movie that exists in Many Saints in Newark, and, like, the theoretical movie that was more dedicated to him. And, yeah, having to, like, split the focus between him and young Tony. I like The Sopranos prequel part more, but that's the least valuable, or that's the least essential part of this movie. I liked how it added more shading to what we already knew. I like spending time with these characters, and I like Chase's, like, tone, and I like his dialogue generally. So it's just more in the sense of The Sopranos, but that, you know, that's not why you make something. Just to give, that's not like a good reason to make something, just to give the viewer more. Especially from someone like David Chase, who, as we've talked about on our Sopranos podcast, hates his audience and thinks very little of them. So I am conflicted about it. I certainly wish it was better than it is. And we can talk about some of the specific reasons why it does and doesn't work. The fatal flaw of The Many Saints of Newark is that, like, you can't have the standalone movie that I think Chase wants to make and the series prequel that he might have felt like he had to make to get this movie, like, funded and made in the first place. Just those two things are automatically at cross purposes with each other. And the more time you spend on one side, the less time for the other, and they're just in constant conflict. So I don't know if there was any version of, like, a 2-hour Sopranos prequel slash standalone mob movie set in the 60s and the 70s that could have worked at all.
Yeah, it seems like one of the, you know, like, it, like, again, like, I, you know, where we're going to go next with this conversation is, like, just talking about prequels in general. And I think there is an inherent conflict of taking a TV show, just any TV show, and trying to adapt it into film, let alone The Sopranos, which is such an archetypal, you know, what we now consider prestige TV. Like, what was great about The Sopranos, and John, I know you just did a lot of rewatching of it, like, was the time spent, right? Like, it's a hangout show. It is, like, it is not about the, like, the plot necessarily, but about the, like, sitting around discussing, you know, living these lives. Like, that's the part of The Sopranos that is the draw to me, or the thing I, like, remember. And, you know, the Dickie Molisanti story in Many Saints is kind of the inverse of that. It is the traditional gangster movie. And The Sopranos at its core was subverting that, you know. It was showing us the everyday home life, the boring moments, the at-home life behind the, like, you know, shootouts and things like that. And I just feel like it was kind of just set up to fail in a way. Like, you know, as a standalone movie, it's perfectly fine. But to take one of the great, or if not the greatest, TV shows in history and try to then, like, feed it to us in this different form, it just seems like it was a bad idea from the start.
Yeah,
and like, I know that you, a dedicated Deadwood fan, and Breaking Bad both now have done this as well in a way. And I was curious, you're like, it seems like, is there a way to make a successful version of this?
I think we have yet to see it. I think the Deadwood, if the Deadwood movie was like if you thought of it as like a single episode of Deadwood, it would probably be the worst episode of Deadwood. The Breaking Bad movie, I didn't need at all. I didn't get anything from it. Like, it exists in this tiny little window between two episodes and immediately after another episode. And fine, it was fine. But just why do these things exist? I have no idea. Like, Better Call Saul exists as a prequel to Breaking Bad, and that's enough.
Which works. Better Call Saul is a really great show, in part, I think, because, one, it's doing its own thing. It's telling its own story. But two, it's sticking with the format that works, you know.
And it also is it also chooses a focus that I think could have worked for Many Saints in Newark by, like, focusing on, I mean, like, Saul's certainly a more major character than Dickie Moltisanti is, but, like, there's a lot of potential there with Dickie Moltisanti.
Were you, because, so I stayed pretty, like, spoiler free going into, I watched on HBO Max, as David Chase intended. But, like, I knew that I had heard that the movie was not really centered on Tony, which I thought was a good choice. And I was intrigued by the idea of it being about Dickie Molisanti. But then once the story started, I felt like the character of Dickie, again, just felt very generic. I don't know if he really lived up to the hype or the, like, again, like, the mystique that he is presented with in the show.
I think that's built into the movie as an excuse, perhaps. Like, Chase would probably land on that as being right. Like, Tony and Christopher towards the end of the series talks about this, where, like, my dad was actually a huge piece of shit. I don't know why I wasted all this time idolizing him and wondering what might have been, because everything I've ever heard about him makes him sound like crap. Not a good guy. Strung out. We don't see him strung out in the movie, but this is how, like, Christopher interprets him. Not a good husband. and died when I was a baby. Like, fuck that guy. And like, Tony is upset by that. It's just one more wedge between him and Christopher. And I think that would be, that would certainly fit with the themes of The Sopranos, where like, nostalgia is poison.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was ever better. Everybody's always terrible.
Which is like, you know, that
which fits with the themes of The Sopranos, but it doesn't necessarily make for a great movie.
That's what I was going to say. Like, that is an interesting idea, but it ultimately, again, it's like, but then we had to sit through, you know, the Dickie Malesanti kind of generic mafia movie.
Like the two flavors of mob movies that work are like the Godfather, which makes these guys into like great Greek tragic figures who are making these big operatic melodramatic moves, and their every motion and gesture is meaningful. And Goodfellas,
right,
or like those kind of, or movies like Goodfellas that really revel in how much theoretical fun it might be to be in the mob, but you would have to, but the trade-off is that you have to be around all these terrible people and maybe get murdered at any moment with no warning or by your best friend.
Right. It's the self, like Goodfellas, I feel like, and I'm sure there's a couple others like in the 90s, that kind of era of like the self-awareness, right? And then that's what that's what The Sopranos is ultimately commenting on. It's like, what if there was a mafia in today's world that had seen Goodfellas? You know, like that's the, you know, that's the brilliance. And it is a weird thing that Many Saints is set in a world before any of that, right? Because it's set in the 60s before Godfather's a movie, right? And before the kind of, again, like the social commentary that Chase is making in the show, The Sopranos, almost all of that is lost in the movie, because the movie is just commenting on The Sopranos. And again, it's just, it like you said, like there's some interesting stuff there, right? Like the kind of revisionist plot of like seeing Johnny Boy arrested from a different perspective, or like ultimately finding out like how Dickie really died, which is like, I don't know if I really wanted that now that I think about it, because that was such a great part of the plot.
It fits with The Sopranos more than anything. But the Sopranos is anti-romantic, the drudgery and the anti-romanticism of this kind of life, of being a criminal. Everybody's stupid. Everybody's dumb. And everybody is lazy. And they're doing this because there's nothing else they would want to do. It's just pure brute strength and ignorance. And it both sucks all the fun out and makes them average.
Right, right.
Which broadly is the right way to think about these kind of people. But yeah, again, it's just is not going to lead to an all-timer mob movie. And like, and The Sopranos was started at, because David Chase really wanted to make a story about, you know, his relationship with his mother, but he had to sell it in some way. So, okay, I'm Italian. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. Why not make it about the mob?
Right, right. And we can kind of pivot here. And that's a good, I think, segue to say, like, I think the parts that did work about the movie were the Sopranos family dynamic with Tony, his mother, Junior, and Johnny Boy. But like, again, it's just kind of like ancillary to the rest of the plot, you know? And I don't know if a whole movie of that would have been, I think that would have been better. I still don't know if that would be needed or necessary. Like, I think it's, again, just a really tough sell to convince me that I needed that. But I did think that part of those parts of the movie worked better. Primarily because I really liked some of the performances there. And I think specifically with Olivia and Junior, I thought they expanded the characters in a way that actually felt necessary. Like, I liked that we got that scene with the high school counselor and Olivia. I thought that was actually good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, any scene with like Leslie Odom Jr.'s character, totally unnecessary to me.
Like, the series mentions the Newark riots. They flash back to the Newark riots or thereabouts. And that may very well have been like a key moment in Chase's life as well, a key like childhood memory. But and then combined with like the oblique way or non-existent way that the Sopranos dealt with race. It was just like understood that these guys are all horrible racists.
Mm-hmm.
And if they work with black people, it's as a means to an end. And they're probably going to end up taking advantage of them at the end of the day anyways. I think in like the intervening period between like the end of the Sopranos and now, Chase felt like he needed to like integrate more minorities into the story. And this is his way to do it. And okay, like third lead, Leslie Odom Jr., but it ultimately serves as like a red herring.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange. I expected, because I knew that was part of the setting of the story, was going to be the Newark kind of race riots.
Smaller piece than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, and also less of a commentary than I thought it would be. Like, I thought it would actually have something. The movie doesn't really have anything to say about that event in history or any connection to, again, the kind of theme, the larger themes of The Sopranos. But in any other movie, you know, that's not too unheard of. But then you think about Chase and the writers of The Sopranos' history and portraying black characters, and that side of The Sopranos is certainly some of the worst moments in the whole show are like, you know, Bokeem Woodbine playing the I forget the character's name, but yeah, like that, or the crack, or the portrayal of like the crack house shootings and like things mm-hmm. like that. Just like, you know, I don't know if I needed like a make good from David Chase in this movie to like correct those wrongs, but it did seem like that was where this could have gone in some direction, and it was kind of strange to me that it didn't. I guess which. You know, again, I don't know if that makes this a better movie or not. I don't know if I really want to see David Chase's, like, you know, racial text, you know, in...
I certainly don't need that.
Right. But it was just, again, it was just a thing that was like, then why even touch on this? I don't know.
Yeah. Like, the whole thing with Leslie Odom Jr.'s character hooking up with Dickie's mistress, that all would have had, like, the courtship of all that. And the actual happening of it that all took place off camera. And then there's the one scene of it included where he's very much being fetishized by her.
Right.
It's not a great scene. If you were to totally cut him out of the movie wouldn't be different in any way,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, never a good sign. And to get back to Tony, to like teenage Tony and like 10-year-old Tony, kind of the same thing there as well. It's just the pieces of those three pieces of the movie just don't fit well together.
Right. It would, again, and I think this is like, I don't know if this is necessarily good criticism. I'm sure it would drive David Chase insane, but like, that's the type of thing where if this were a miniseries, I think it would make more sense, because yep. the more time spent and the more you could kind of flesh out the world and interconnect these stories, that felt kind of missing. Which part of that I think is that you only have 2 hours to do this, you know? So mm-hmm. it's like the Tony stuff, we can talk about the Tony stuff, because I think, again, I liked it. I expected to dislike it more, you know? And then I thought it played, I liked that the story was not centered on Tony, and I liked that I didn't feel too like, too preachy about like, you know, I think I tweeted this as a joke, but like, I also kind of half believed that like we were going to see young Tony staring at a family of ducks at some point, you know, like,
yeah,
like I really, and there are parts in the movie that, especially the ending, which we can talk about as well, but like there are parts that venture on that I don't care for, but I thought overall, I liked that it did not go where I thought it was going to go with young Tony. If anything, it really reminded me more of AJ, and I thought it did a good job of maybe actually making young Tony connecting to the character of AJ made a lot more sense to me. But that was really my only takeaway from. I thought the performance, you know, again, uncanny at times. Like, you know, that's remarkable that they were able to, you know, that his son, just the little things he was able to do. That maybe aren't even acting, but just inherent, but like, just like the smirk on his face and the way he looks up, and, you know, it was just uncanny at times. So I, you know, overall, I liked that better than I thought I would, but there's still parts that kind of yep. stuck out.
The only exception to like the Solo type prequel stuff. This is how he got his dice. This is how he got his name.
Yeah.
Just awful, awful stuff. The only one of those. And I was really, really concerned about that kind of stuff and had my dander up about it showing up in the movie. And like, I would have made a big red mental note of that if it ever came up. The only one was like Baby Christopher and the intoning of the Italian grandma about how babies know stuff. Too much.
That was bad. Yeah, there was a couple like Easter egg type things that I actually enjoyed. Like I liked the callback to, is it the raven outside the funeral that then?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Christopher sees that in his, right? I thought that was good. But yeah, that's a great example is the scene where Baby Christopher is crying because he knows one day this guy's going to like strangle and murder him. I was like, well, I don't know if we need it laid out like that, you know? That was unnecessary.
I was really concerned that we were going to get the origin of Junior's talent for pussy eating when he's like lying in bed with a broken back with his mistress. I can't move. This isn't going to work. What are we going to do?
I had that same thought during that scene that I was like, are they going to bring that back? Because that, I honestly, I would have liked that actually. That would have been great. That is one of my favorite episodes of The Sopranos is when he shoves the pie in her face. That's one of the
best. Yeah. I would generally agree with that. I feel the opposite. I feel like that would have been just way too much. That would have been way too much bum powdering for fans of the show.
Yeah.
But thankfully nothing came of that.
Mm-hmm.
Or missed out on a great origin story for that particular trait.
I would have, if this were a mini series, I think we could have had
time. Yeah, we could have pulled an episode out of that.
Yeah. But I do think like the strangest part of all of this, connecting the prequel to the show for me was the opening voiceover, which I just thought was like totally out of a different, much shittier movie. Like I was shocked at the just one to do voiceover in general, I thought was, pretty hacky. But then to do like Christopher from the grave being like, that's my Uncle Tony, he's the one who killed me, like that was weak on, that's something beneath. That was like if David Chase were not involved with this at all and this were like a group of writers coming in, I would be like, yeah, that's what I'd expect. But the fact that he wrote this and it starts that way, I thought that was a terrible start to the movie.
I haven't read in depth about the making of this movie, but I have like gleaned little tiny bits here and there. And I've read that he like struggled with how to frame it. And yes. I think Christopher's mono or like voiceover only comes in at the beginning and the end. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Or is it sprinkled in throughout?
I don't know if it's at the end. I was laughing too hard at the pinky promise.
Yeah.
So. I think I also heard in interviews, I think they ran through a couple different characters that it was
good. Yeah, they had Carmella doing it.
Which I don't know if any of them were, like, I don't know why any of them would, I know that I'm watching a Sopranos prequel, I don't need a voiceover to tell me like, and this is where we all started. Like, again, a worse movie would do that. And this, I don't know why they chose to do it.
The two like big Sopranos critics, Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zollerseitz. The latter, Matt Zollerseitz, had something on Twitter about how, like, oh, well, Christopher's doing the monologue because he's writing this movie. He's telling the story to whoever's listening to him. Yeah.
Very generous. I get it. But
that's very generous. And that also gives the movie an out for maybe being a little too tidy or poorly written because Christopher is writing it. Christopher would poorly write a movie. And I never had patience for that kind of stuff.
I like that idea only if they had gone like full measure and it was like people were like misspeaking and saying words incorrectly because one of the great parts of The Sopranos is when you get to see Christopher's script and just like everything is misspelled, you know? And like, I would have liked that. Like if this was almost like a William Faulkner, like Sound and Fury, like we're hearing the story through Christopher telling the story. That would be amazing. But, obviously that would be impossible. But
sure. Yeah. Like Christopher wrote a scene between Livia and Tony's guidance counselor in that case. Come on. If there would have required a lot of commitment on the part of the movie to like really sell that. And they don't like that. That version of the movie would have maybe been the better like standalone movie because it would have just been about Dickie, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't need that kind of thing generally. Unless if you're, especially if you're going to have like the Charlie Kaufman nature of like that, this kind of super meta storytelling, like I don't know that that's Chase's strong suit.
Yeah. So did you, as again, we're both pretty big Sopranos fans. Did you feel like the things that they really, the main one I'm thinking of is like finding out that Junior was behind Dickie's death, right? Did you feel like we needed any of that plot uncovered?
No.
Yeah, that's how I
felt.
Yeah, I kind of thought like, you know, I think the scene in The Sopranos when Christopher kills the cop who supposedly killed his father, right? Like, that scene just works so much better if we don't know, you know?
Well, I think in the movie, it's still possible. It's still possible that that's the guy that Junior.
I guess that's true. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, it was one of those things with the nature of prequels in general where I don't know if I needed some of the ambiguity of the original story uncovered here. Because I actually thought some of that worked better.
It just fits with the theme again of this was always terrible.
Yeah.
This was never a noble thing.
Set up to lose, yeah.
Something I really liked in the series that the movie continues is you start the series, like Livia is on screen, you see how just terrible it would be to be around her. And Johnny Boy is long dead. And Tony, all he can talk about is what a great guy he was. He has all these anecdotes ready to go about he did this, he did that, he was a stand-up guy, et cetera, et cetera. And as the show goes on, you gain greater sympathy for Livia and more antipathy for Johnny Boy. In the movie, when Johnny Boy is actually a character and actually moving through the world, period on the end of the sentence, this guy was terrible. As terrible, if not more terrible, than Livia. But Livia, her awfulness is just louder. So it's easy for her to overshadow her husband, who is just totally uninterested. The most racist of perhaps the whole crew. Just nothing to offer. Absolutely nothing. We don't get like a single moment really of him bonding with Tony or any of his other children. Being like he was nicer in the memories that Tony brought to the show, he just totally without warmth. Like this version of John Bernthal is the version from like Wolf of Wall Street where he's just human garbage.
Yeah, it felt of all the kind of, and I know he wasn't really in the show much, but of all the characters that they kind of reimagine in their younger, you know, in those days. His was kind of the thinnest to me. Like besides, like I thought, like Dickie and the new characters were all pretty generic. But he, I felt like it was pretty one note, and there's less to be explored with him to me. Whereas, like I thought, again, like Olivia and Junior, and even some of the side guys, like I really liked those performances more. I thought they're I thought. The thing that worked best for me in the whole movie was Corey Stoll and Vera Farmiga. Like, I thought those were incredible performances, really. And I thought those characters had a more interesting prequel-ness to them. There's something to learn there. Whereas, like, Johnny Boy was, again, and I think he's a fine actor, John Bernthal, but kind of delivers the same thing no matter what role he's playing. So ultimately, it was...
Fair. I mean, you just come away from the movie, especially, and that might be its greatest contribution, is just further explaining the character of Livia, or if not explaining, then diagnosing. Like, she's ill.
Yeah.
Johnny Boy is just dumb.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing... He's incapable of any kind of, like, intervention. He is exactly the person he is. He doesn't have a chemical imbalance like Livia does. Like, her problems could be solved if her illness made it impossible for her to accept treatment. Whereas he is just a lump.
Yeah.
We mentioned like some of the supporting characters. Like, I thought a lot of the makeup was bad in this movie. Yeah. And a lot of the makeup had to be used, not had to, was chosen to be used to like make the physical resemblance greater. Could have used another pass. And I would also say generally on those, on some of those like smaller characters who are, you know, just going to be like in background, not going to have their specific opportunity to really stand out. So what's really left of them other than to call back to their future Sopranos characters?
Mm-hmm.
I think in most cases, they weren't just doing impersonations, with one exception.
Yeah, that's what, okay, so that's what I was going to say. I thought, again, Vera Farmiga, Corey Stoll, excellent. I thought those were great. The next tier, like the tier below them.
Yeah, like the goons.
Yeah, there's a big drop-off, I thought, as far as the... I mean, the Silvio, I wouldn't even call it a performance, because it's like an SNL character to me. Like, I didn't think that worked at all. I thought that guy that got to play...
Paulie?
Yeah, Paulie. It was such a strange casting. That guy is like I just saw him in the new Bond movie. He's the blonde American.
And it's just last name is Magnuson. He's he's a Viking.
Yeah, I thought that was... I didn't think he was bad necessarily, but I was like, you know... I mean, that's a tough role to cast, I'm sure, because, like, again, that I don't even remember his name, but Paulie Walnut's, like, one of a kind, you know? Like, I don't even know how you even try to play that role, but like, not that guy was bad, but just like, again, set up for failure. And then everyone else I thought was pretty, you know, that's like what you expect, you know? So like, I thought the Silvio Dante stuff was pretty goofy in a bad way, and everyone else was pretty forgettable, you know?
Yeah.
And even we get Carmella at the end, and I thought that was like, you know,
okay, I guess. Yeah, I mentioned it in my review that, like, of all the traits of, like, we didn't get hornball Tony at all from teenage Tony. So I could have just like not I could have got rid of any of his like girlfriends or anything. She's just present in a scene. Like his stuff with his crew, I think, would have been more interesting.
Yes,
like, I think get young Ralphie in there. That would have been fun.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought Silvio and Tony were the same age.
Yeah, so that was an interesting thing. I never really thought much about it, and then as I was watching the movie, it made sense to me. Like it wasn't like I felt like it was retconning anything like that. But like, yeah, I guess he is younger than those guys, and I don't really know how old they're supposed to be in the movie too. Like I kind of thought those actors are obviously old, but like, you know, realistically, those guys could just be college age, you know, but not in college. So I didn't think that was too out of, you know, I guess Silvio's bald at some point, so I guess he is old. I don't know. But I think that did add a bit to the character of Tony, that he was this kind of, at some point, once he joins the business, he is this like quick uprising, you know, like hotshot in some way, I guess. Whereas the rest of these guys are kind of always meant to be lackeys, which I thought was fine. But I think, again, the more interesting movie would be to see these guys doing jobs in their younger days. You know, like, I was kind of hoping at some point Tony would get involved in the business, because, like, that is a bit more exciting, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting that they placed him in high school as opposed to, like we understand the history of like Tony's biography. Like we understand that I guess he's like a junior or a senior at this point in high school, and he's going to go to wherever for college for a semester and a half, and he's going to drop out. And then Rutgers. Probably in earnest. Did he go to Rutgers?
That to Rutgers.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty good. And then I would imagine once he dropped out, he was pretty in earnest, like joining the business. So yeah, the choice to place it, there's nothing in the show, to the best of my recollection, that ties Dickie's death to Tony being in high school. It would have been very easy to have like a hungry Tony who wants to be more involved, as opposed to the high school version, who I think most, like, very importantly for the character, you can't imagine this version of Tony going in any direction. Like, he could go on to sell the patio furniture and be okay with it.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense from the movie that, and I don't think Chase would have given it either or subscribes to this, where like this person had no chance. He was always going to join the family business. And I don't think that's true.
Yeah. Sorry. Let me just real, because I know listeners will be upset. Let me correct myself. Tony attended Seton Hall, but James Gandolfini in real life attended Rutgers. So classic mistake.
Seton Hall, still pretty good. Good for Tony.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Many Saints of Newark. So I can't, as like unwieldy as it is, I still had to deal with it.
Can we talk about Dickie for a second? Just because I think the biggest mistake of the movie itself, if this, you know, if we have to go with this plot and we have to make a prequel of The Sopranos, I didn't think that actor was bad, but I was like baffled. Again, if the aspiration from David Chase was that this was a movie, not a TV show, right? And he stressed that like people should go see this in a theater and all that stuff. Why wouldn't you not get an A-list actor for that role? You know, like I just thought that guy was fine. He was not bad, but I mean, that was like a TV show performance. It was not a movie star performance. And I just think that's like a big, and I like, I kept watching it and I know this guy's not actually Italian, but I kept being like, this is low rent Christian Bale, you know, like that's the performance that was given. And I don't know if Christian Bale would have worked again, cause he's like not Italian, but that's the level of actor I think this role needed, right? Like you needed somebody to like be a movie star for this character that we're being sold, you know, is, you know, worthy of following through a Sopranos prequel. And I just thought that was such mediocre casting. I don't know.
That's definitely fair. Like, you do need to think this person is, even within like the realm of the Sopranos, is a like a charismatic guy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe more than most, that is true. Most of his like co-workers in the mob, but like really charismatic. Like he needs to really shine bright. And that's fair. You don't really get it. Like, yeah. Him being the son of Ray Liotta, who you get a sense of, Hollywood Dick, who you get a sense of as being a very big personality. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
I have to agree with you.
And again, like The Sopranos being this subversion of the, you know, the original mafia movies, his character really just seemed like Al Pacino in Godfather. Like it's not that far off from Michael Corleone. Like it just felt too generic as far as casting goes and the character himself and the plot of the whole, that part of the movie, just a total, you know, straight down the middle mafia movie, which again was not what I enjoyed about The Sopranos. But
there's some proto, there's some proto Tony in Dickie,
mm-hmm.
where like he his version of therapy is with his uncle, also played by Ray Liotta in prison. Which, you know, whatever, that's fine.
Those scenes could be totally, I get the parallel of the kind of therapy makes sense, but cut those out and the movie's fine.
Sure. And it rhymes with like Tony's therapy, where like, mm-hmm. this is not going to work if you don't change what you're doing. Like you can't just talk about feeling bad about murdering your father. What are you doing like to atone? Are you just going on as normal? Or are you changing your actions? And I mean, that's like with all these guys, of course, like they're just incapable. But that's just more of what was said over like 80 something episodes of The Sopranos, mm-hmm. as opposed to something new.
Yeah.
So, a flaw.
So then my final thought, do you want to see David Chase return in any way, like to the world of The Sopranos after seeing this?
Did you ever see his movie Not Fade Away?
Yes, which I thought was pretty good.
I agree. I like that movie a lot. Totally different. Could have very well been its own version of a Sopranos prequel. Like, it's about a teenager who is the same age as Michael Gandolfini, or the character that Michael Gandolfini plays in this movie. I thought that was perceptive. I thought that had great Obviously, great work from James Gandolfini in it. But that was in 2012, and that was an utter failure, just like this movie is. So I kind of wonder how many opportunities he's going to get. And he's like, he's old. He's like in his 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many more cracks he'll get. Probably they would let him do another one of these if he really wanted to. I don't know where it would be set or what period or what other story needs to be told. Like the thing with like The Many Saints in Newark is that there was more to tell in The Sopranos about this single character. Mm-hmm. That's kind of it. And I don't know what else. And I don't know what anything else would be.
Yeah, there's kind of like, they kind of left it open for like a Leslie Odom Jr. character, like for his character to go on, which I was like,
no way.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who wants that. Maybe Leslie Odom Jr. does, but no one else. And then I thought about like, would I watch a miniseries of like young Tony and the gang? And I was like, no. After seeing this, no. You know. So again, I just think that's the question that like after watching. That I was like, just don't do prequels. Like, that's the real lesson of all this is like, the great TV shows throughout history, just leave them as TV shows. There's no, I don't think there's a successful way to do this. So,
you know. the Friends reunion, the Parks. I don't and won't watch Friends, but that was the thing that happened, and then just went. Its own way, and like Parks and Rec had a Zoom episode that, wasn't any good.
Yeah,
this doesn't work. This doesn't work.
Yeah, and again, like The Sopranos, you know, and I think they kind of, I think I heard David Chase talk about this in some of the interviews, but like in the last 2 years or so, because of just binge watching at home, has gone up, like. The rewatch on The Sopranos is still a great rewatch. Like, if you want more Sopranos, you can just watch The Sopranos, you know? So my recommendation to any, I mean, if anybody's listening at this point and isn't just a diehard Sopranos, you know, rewatcher, like, just rewatch The Sopranos. Don't make more of it and don't, you know, you don't have to spend your time watching the movie.
Yeah, like, I've been watching several episodes and we've been podcasting about it and, like, they're still great. There's even the bad ones are still they are still great, and like it's really retaining its legacy and its watchability amongst like the next and the next generation. Like you still hear stuff about The Sopranos every so often. It hasn't just receded into the background or just gone away. It's still relevant. It's still extremely watchable and funny, and it hasn't even burned like PC cards or anything like that. Because these guys are awful. And like I think like the big turn for the golden age of television or whatever was like you don't actually have to like the characters that you're watching on television. And like that was the big breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And it like opened up a whole new like suite of plot choices and character choices. And we've kind of forgotten that, I think, again.
Or just gotten too much of it. Right. I think.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It went too far. Yes. But yeah. I there is, it's more so with movies than with TV, but there's like a sense of where like, well, I can't watch a movie about a bad person because I'm ratifying their actions. Like it's kind of swung in the other direction. And like, that's no good.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sopranos still great. Many things in New York, sadly, just fine. So we'll say goodbye to you, Pierce.
Yes, you can't see it, John, but I'm holding out my pinky finger
for you
to grab onto with your pinky finger. So,
I'm dead. So,
yep. All right. Well, have fun talking about my dad's favorite movie that he mentions to me every time I see him for the last like 6 months.
You're going to need to be more specific because I think it's every dad's favorite movie.
Yes.
Which dad?
Yes, my father. News of the World. Every time, literally every time I see him, he asks me if I have watched it yet. So maybe I can get him on the pod to talk to you.
Available on Hulu. Okay, yeah, I'll be talking about it in the next like 5 minutes or so. So if
he's okay, I'll let you know. All right.
Have a good night, Pierce.
Yep.
Okay, now that Pierce is gone, I'm going to continue on with this episode wherein I talk to myself. So listeners, congratulations, you're in for a big treat. Or are you? We'll see. Our next movie is News of the World. This is a movie directed by Paul Greengrass, a very un-Paul Greengrass movie, if you know anything about this director. He broke out with a movie about the Bloody Sunday shootings in Ireland in the 70s, went on to make United 93 about September 11th. He also made the second two Bourne movies, and he's famous for those kinds of like quick cuts. Not quick cuts. He's famous for those shaky cam style and really frenetic action, or conversely, like real time recreations of these like terrible events that happened in history, including like the Norway Brevik shooting that killed like 70 something teenagers. That's 22nd July, a movie I will almost surely never watch because, good God, that sounds horrifying. In News of the World, he is quite staid compared to his normal style. This is a Western. It's a classic Western set in Texas a few years after the Civil War. Tom Hanks plays Captain Kidd, who is a guy who rides from town to town, reading the news to the townspeople who are either illiterate or they just don't get regular paper services to their towns. He comes upon a lone girl in the woods on a trail after her driver has been lynched. She only speaks Kiowa, an Indian tribe in Texas who has recently been displaced. She was kidnapped by them when she was a very young girl after her settler family was murdered out on the plains. And he has to bring her to her family. So this is like, not unlike Many Saints of Newark, this is two movies in conflict with each other. This is the reuniting the girl, Johanna, with her family. And like the reason I feel like this movie got made was because who wouldn't want to see Tom Hanks deliver the news in a comforting, kind, authoritative fashion to people who are desperate for information and don't know what's happening in the rest of the world? Like, Tom Hanks, he's a guy who is like essentially America's uncle, I guess. He's like developed this persona and this cultural niche of a lightly bearded guy at a barbecue who's friendly with everybody, knows everybody. Just everybody he ever meets, he would glad hand, give a nice warm handshake and a hug, and he would, like Clinton-esque, turn you into the only person in the world when you're talking to him. The roles he takes really reinforces that persona of gentle, kind, competence, and pleasantness. We're talking about movies like Sully, Captain Phillips, The Post. He played Mr. Rogers, for God's sake. He was like, he was whatever that Battleship movie was about, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, that also came out in 2020. He makes what I think most people would call dad movies. Movies that are about competent males who are unconflicted and generally upstanding virtues of masculinity, of like proper non-toxic masculinity in the world, or counterexamples in opposition to the toxic masculinity that exists in News of the World and gives Captain Kidd something to like exist against. So within that, he's kind of just gotten less and less interesting as an actor. He's kind of just playing the same thing over and over again as he settles into his old age. I don't know how old Tom Hanks is, probably in his early 60s. I don't know. I can find out easily enough, but I won't. His character, Captain Kidd, is a former Confederate soldier, and I feel like that's the only part, play to making him anything close to conflicted or unlikable. But the movie goes out of its way early on to forgive him and absolve him of any of like the racial crimes of the Confederacy by having him look concerned about the lynched black man nearby, instead of sure that this person did something to warrant this horrible treatment. So congratulations, Captain Kidd, you aren't a monster. Like, that's the baseline. The movie itself is a fairly bog standard Western that does have this this little nugget at the center of it, like the obvious burgeoning relationship between Hanks and Johanna, played by a newcomer, a young girl, named Helena Zengel, who was like very well received for this performance. And like, it's a good kid performance. Certainly she's speaking in a different language. Maybe a language that doesn't even exist anymore, frankly, like Kiowa. I have no idea. I had never heard of that tribe before. Not that I'm an expert in any way or an authority, but it is a good kid performance. She and Hanks do have chemistry. They do help each other. She's not just along for the ride, and he's not just dragging her by the collar to places where she doesn't really want to go. She gets into his job, and I think in a very cute and compelling way. But it's his job as a newsreader that makes this movie exist. I don't think this movie does exist without this newsreader angle, especially in this time period. This movie would have been made in 2019 and 2020. This was released in the winter of 2020. And it's just the most obvious thing in the world. Like, you're going to have someone putting on their little glasses and standing in front of a crowd of potentially hostile people, and they're going to read the news to them. And I mean, obviously it's Tom Hanks. It speaks to this like good night and good luck style desire to return to the good old days of the 50s and 60s and somewhat the 70s, where you hear this a lot from resistance types. I don't know that Paul Greengrass is one of them. He is English, so he might feel the same way in a Brexit way, in a Boris Johnson way, but this idea that the world was simpler and truer and more honest when information and the doings of powerful forces were filtered through equally powerful forces and not very many of them, namely like network anchors, your Murrows and your Cronkites, etc., etc. And I'm just so deeply skeptical of that off the bat. Coming after talk about The Many Saints of Newark and The Sopranos, just like this idea that nostalgia is poison and nostalgia is ill-placed and nostalgia always forgets the ways that those guys screwed up. And they screwed up. So that angle just doesn't really work on me. The showmanship angle of the news reading, I think, is a little more compelling. But again, just like the movie makes plays at its time period, in the sense this featured heavily in Deadwood, or more accurately, it featured heavily in like the background reading of Deadwood and like the behind the scenes features and like special features on the DVD. This featured heavily into David Milch, who created Deadwood. It featured in his idea of the Old West in like the 1870s, 10 years after the Civil War, where just like you could not be sure who you were talking to. You were pointing guns at each other. In very recent history, you walk into a bar on the frontier, of which Texas was very much a part in this period of history, even though it's a state. You walk into a bar and maybe someone is from Tennessee and maybe another guy is from Connecticut. You're going to introduce yourselves to these like potentially mortal enemies very recently. Like, maybe they're okay with it. Maybe it's bygones being bygones. Maybe there's still murderous rage there. Who knows? And that uncertainty informs like every interaction you have with a stranger. Like the social fabric has been just totally frayed. And you get Deadwood and all of its roughness. But here, you get the very conciliatory Hanks, and he just doesn't really have any feelings about the war, other than he wished it didn't happen, like the most generic possible interpretation of these events. Like, he quiets down a lot of anti-union sentiment at one of his news readings, and you really wonder if that would have been his first impulse. You get why he runs across just a wild camp that's being run by a guy who fashions himself into a king, like a warrior king, who puts out his own newspaper about all of his dastardly deeds that are reframed as like frontier hero Pecos Bill type stuff. And like, you get why Hanks would reject that, but you really wonder if he would reject like the Indian removal stuff, the burgeoning or like the dark future that's coming for the South with like the end of Reconstruction and all of the revanchism that's going to happen and retrenchment of established interests. And you really don't get much of a sense of that in this movie. And like expounding on that and really fleshing out the kind of place the post-Civil War South might have been. Like, sure, there are the Union soldiers enforcing order, but it's just not quite enough of that stuff to really paint a full picture of the environment. And like, it's that kind of stuff that would have made News of the World into a really standout Western. I think the potential was there. But I think the best this movie can do is being, as I said at the beginning, that's fairly standard, a fairly standard Western. If you don't like Westerns, then you're probably not going to like this. If you have a lot more tolerance for Westerns, if you enjoy Westerns, then this is going to give you that enjoyment. Like the weapons are right, I assume. I don't know if you can shoot coins out of a shotgun or not, here or there. It's a fun little scene in this movie. But yeah, it's got all the hallmarks. Like, I feel like John Ford could have made this movie in the 50s. And maybe that's part of its appeal. For me, when it needed to work, it did. Like, the relationship between Joanna and Captain Kidd is successful, I think. As inevitable as it is, the movie fools me into forgetting that it was always going to end it in the fashion that it does. So, News of the World, pretty good. Pretty good. Our final movie is Coda. This is a classic Sundance hit, big or the equivalent of standing ovations in the 2020 Sundance Festival, which would have been, mostly over Zoom. I think that happened in person in small groups, I think. I don't know exactly, but this was a huge Sundance hit. It sold for the most money ever to a distributor, namely Apple Plus. And Apple released it on its platform to not a lot of fanfare. The Apple platform is a mystery. There's so little content on that. I feel like if you just buckled down and like took a month or two, you could watch literally everything on Apple Plus. And just the idea of that on any other service, on your Hulus, on your Primes, on your Netflixes, that seems completely impossible. Apple Plus is weird. They do good work. They have good movies here and there. Coda being one, but I don't understand. They can't buy the rights to some stuff to like flesh it out. Whatever. Coda is an acronym standing for Child of Deaf Adults. This is a movie directed and written by Sean Hedder, who adapted the movie from a French film. The difference beyond the different languages is that the French film cast hearing actors in all of the roles that were inhabited by deaf characters, whereas the opposite is true in the American version. Here, the deaf characters are played by deaf actors, the father and the mother and the brother of the lead, but they are in fact deaf. Coda is about the hearing daughter, the hearing teenage daughter of this family. They are fishermen in I want to say Massachusetts, and she is at a turning point in her life where she is going to either or follow her own interests, which are not fishing, or is she gonna like stay with her family and be a fisherman herself and like help her family be, as the hearing interlocutor between like her deaf family and the hearing world. This movie is Billy Elliot for deaf people. It's a blue-collar kid breaking out from their family towards some kind of artistic pursuit, and Billy Elliot was dance. Here it's music, and like Billy Elliot, the dad in both of these scenarios steals all of the best moments. This is like a crowd pleaser, a heart warmer. It hits all the right beats. Even at like with News of the World, like you see all this stuff coming. The movie can really only end in a couple of different ways, and it doesn't really surprise in how it does choose to end. I've been speaking a lot about how like the purpose of these movies, like the reason for existence of these movies, and in the case of Coda, it's because of like the deaf angle, the deaf characters, what it's like to be deaf in the world, what it's like to be a coda. What it, and I'm like, that's the thing I do find interesting is like, there is always these, there's always the subtext in these kind of movies where there are minority characters, disabled characters, whatever in the background, or just any kind of minority in the background, and then the movie just happens to be about an able-bodied, often white person, and the common refrain is often, why don't you make the movie about the minorities whose lives just might be more interesting than the movie that you choose to make the person that you choose to make the lead in the movie. And well, I generally agree with that, especially as you just watch more movies, only so many ways, so many stories can be told. I do find it interesting when a work, TV, a movie or whatever does choose to focus on what it is like to have like a neuroatypical brother, like in something like Atypical on Netflix. That show is an ensemble, and the autistic character does play a major role, but his sister does as well, and like what it has meant for her life to live as the sibling who just requires less energy and takes up less space in the mental space of their parents. Like, I do find that interesting, and like how they've had to adapt be a caretaker early in their life, as the lead in Coda does. Like, like this movie could have had a prologue where it's the lead as like a 7-year-old talking to a tax accountant or something for her parents, because you get a sense that it is said that her brother can lip read, but just not very well. So they are very much at a disadvantage, where in an environment where most, if not all, people don't know sign language and therefore can't communicate. So that angle justifies Coda's existence, and within that angle, the movie packs on a lot of like standard coming of age type issues, school interests, college looming, or just the next stage of life looming. Teen romance, of course, has to rear its head in this movie, although that is ultimately indistinguishable from any number of like Netflix teen romances. And you also get into like the economics of fisheries and the interaction of fishermen with the government. That on its own is all variably interesting and very variably well done, but each additional side plot takes away from the main thrust, which is again like the way that the lead interacts with her family and the way that she is able to help them interact with the world. Getting into the deaf characters themselves, like one of my favorite movies from last year was Sound of Metal, and even more than Sound of Metal, Coda really communicates how interpretive and expressive and descriptive sign language can be. First and foremost, through the actor Troy Kotsur, who plays the lead, Ruby, played by Emilia Jones. Troy Kotsur plays her father, Frank. He is like a Cirque du Soleil master of physical comedy, based on the way that he signs, the way he syncs up what he's signing with the expressions on his face. Like, it's this incredible combination of I barely have the language to describe how amazing it is, and also how incredibly funny it is. I don't know. I don't know if there is an exact sign for ejaculation in American Sign Language, but if there isn't, Troy Kotsur just came up with one for the screen, and it's clear. It can only be the one thing, and there's no room for interpretation other than what it is. It is amazing to watch him sign. And I Independent Spirit Award at least for this guy, and maybe more, who knows. It's a really incredible performance. Anytime there is a disability or a movie about people with disabilities, there's almost always some level of pity threaded through the movie, and you don't get any of that in Coda, because he and his family, who are also played by Marley Matlin as his wife, and Daniel Durant as his adult son, they are fine. They're doing fine. Their lives are in no way made worse by the disability. Marginally more difficult, but they are extremely satisfied people within their family. This is just one thing about them. They're also horny as fuck, and they're very frank with their children, and they love their children, and they're passionate about what they do. And this just happens to be one facet of their lives. The Lee's interest, what's her name? Ruby. To go a little negative on Coda, I don't know. It's a little cute that her interest has to be music. Did it have to be music? The most affecting scene of the movie is her dad feeling her throat while she's singing to him. A very beautiful scene. And if you can't have that scene without her interest being the one thing her parents can't appreciate, which I don't know if that's accurate. I don't know if deaf people can't appreciate music. There is that scene. There are several scenes in Sound of Metal where Riz Ahmed's character who is a drummer is teaching like at a deaf school or volunteering at a deaf school while he's in, it's not rehab. It's kind of rehab, whatever. He's working with children and like teaching them how to drum. It's not like they're totally baffled by like why anybody would do this. So it's not like deaf people can't appreciate music, but that's kind of the opinion of Coda. It's very melodramatic, I guess. And keeping with those like kind of quibbles, like there was a lot of lead up into the movie, into the first half of the movie where the fisheries are in trouble. The fisheries are dwindling. They have to pay middlemen. They have to worry about regulators. And the solution for that is for the central family to like strike out on their own and sell fish directly to buyers directly to restaurants or whatever, or supermarkets. And that is said to be difficult, and that is said to be likely to fail. The movie totally loses interest in it the second that they make the decision to do so. And I feel like that would have been interesting. And to say nothing of like, is no one, like no one's going to be interested in their failure. No one's going to want this to crap out. Like the middleman who we see briefly is just going to like throw his hands up and walk away and like, well, they got me. My business is now dead. And now I can't, you know, I may very well have been like mooching and rent seeking off of these fishermen, but now what do I do? I guess I go somewhere else. It's over. The movie just kind of forgets about that kind of thing. But those are small complaints that do detract from the movie in totality, but the central experience of Coda is to be like buffeted along by like this pleasant story about a minority and a minority family. And you get a peek into their world, you get a peek into them as humans, full humans, and not just as people defined by their disability. And when the movie needs to like swing especially hard, it does indeed connect. And it's just hard to imagine a person watching this movie and not being moved at this or that moment. So that's Coda, and that's our three movies for this month. I instituted a break at the Munich Movie Club. Season 8 just ended. We're going to start season 9. Probably going to steer our movie selections in a more relevant direction instead of like just picking randomly from like the breadth of all of cinema, or at least the share of cinema that's readily available on streaming services. We're going to try and make it a little more relevant in the sense of like, our next round is probably going to be about Dune, the Denny Villeneuve version, or movies related to Dune, or movies related to Villeneuve, or maybe Timothée Chalamet. I don't know. Who knows? I haven't made a decision yet. I need to make a decision soon, though, because it's been a couple weeks, and we know you hunger for those movie breakdowns that we offer here at the Munich Movie Club. You can find those on our website, munichmovie.club. You can follow us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club, Twitter at Munich Movie Club, and Instagram at Munich Movie Mediocre Movie Club. I'm John underscore Kissel at letterbox.com, a great site that I would recommend anybody join if they haven't. great for film journaling and creating a watch list, etc., etc. It's a great site. Hasn't been infected by any of the ugly parts of the internet, which is nice. You can say that about less and less stuff these days. Thank you for listening. Check out our Sopranos episodes. We still have one more to put out at some point in the future. We'll get that out there into our feed eventually. And in the meantime, thank you for listening tonight. We appreciate your patronage. And we just really like talking about movies here. Or at least I do, as I've been talking to myself for the last half an hour or so. Have a good night.